MZTV.
This is Martin Zender here, still from the top of the middle of the state of Ohio. Founded in, what is it, 1903? I don't know when exactly, but a lot of presidents are from Ohio. The Wright brothers, who invented the airplane, are from Ohio. So I'm a very happy Ohioan, proud to be an Ohioan, and I'm always happy to be able to talk to you. My friends, I'm making an extra show here in Canton. To me, it's the same day as yesterday's show. Nothing has changed as far as my diagnosis. No, I didn't get any call that said, oh, our mistake. We were looking at the wrong specimen. You're actually Superman, and nothing bad will ever happen to you. Now, I didn't get that call. I am still at my sister's house in Canton, Ohio. I found some cool pictures. Kelly had some pictures on the wall. I just wanted to show you that we had the coolest parents ever. They're both dead, but this is my mom and dad in Pass Christiana, Mississippi. This is where my mom was living. And look how cool they are. I guess my dad was attracted to my mom because of her legs. My mom has good legs, admittedly. My dad was a rugged, tough guy. Look how cool my parents are, man. They're just super cool people. And the greatest parents anybody could ever have. Yeah, let me tell you that. So, and then my grandfather was the first master photographer in the state of Ohio. And so we got some good photos, Kelly and me, of when we were kids. So this is my sister and me. This is probably in 1963, maybe 64. I look like I'm maybe 4 years old, so it might be 1963. Isn't that adorable? Look at that. She loves me. She loves me not. She loves me. She loves me not. She loves me. And we still love each other. We still do. What a beautiful picture. I'm 2 years older than her. She's my only sibling. So I'm like four. She's two. And this is us several years later in 1980. Two. It's either 81. It's probably 81. Now we're not just cute. We're super cool. Especially Kelly. She looks, I got to admit, my sister's a hot chick. I think the only, let me try to focus. The only reason I had friends in high school was because they wanted to meet my sister. They wanted to date my sister. In order to get to her, they had to go through me. Or they thought it was easier, less intimidating, I guess. So this is us after we moved out of the house. This has to be 1981, but all right. Some good-looking people in my family. I'm happy to announce that Seth Vollenkamp and Stephen Janowski have thoroughly debunked the teaching of Liam McAllister. And I feel bad for Liam, because just like I feel bad for Richard Golko for coming out solid on this non-preexistence thing. I just feel terrible because their position is being destroyed, systematically destroyed, because I've never seen a position, the non-preexistence, I've never seen a position more lacking of evidence. I've never seen people supporting it spooling out such human reasoning. It's pure human reasoning. It's shocking to hear men of such faith spooling out human reasoning. But that human reasoning is exposed and destroyed by Seth Vollenkamp and Stephen Janowski. This is part three. I'm going to link it down here. Part three. It's almost 4 hours. I mean, these guys are thorough. But it's without question that one of the greatest rebuttals I've ever heard, because, well, there's Spooky Tooth again. It is just so thorough. And I would have all the respect in the world for Liam, who's a great guy. Liam, you have to admit when you're wrong. And Spooky Tooth, really? And it's noble to realize when you've been beat and this position is untenable. So I beg you to accept this exposure, this rebuke, and come to the light, come to the light. All right, that's enough on that. I'm just going to link that down here. I'm impressed with it, really. Let's see. I want to talk to you a little bit about the meeting with my son Gabe, my sister Kelly, and my son Paul at Paul's Church. 4 hours. Whew, I don't think the Council of Nicaea was that lengthy. The one thing that really sticks with me is when I went on this inspired rant, but it was not a rant as more as it was a teaching. I'm a spooky dude. I said, Paul, I want you to just imagine for one moment that the salvation of all is true, that it really is God's intention to bring everything back to him. All human history will be consummated in Christ. I know you don't believe it, Paul, but just for once, try to imagine the glory and the greatness of what this would mean for God's creation and what sort of reflection it would have of the cross of Christ, which came to reconcile all things to God and indeed conciliated all human beings to God. Just imagine, please, that this is true. And Paul, imagine for 1 minute that Satan himself, who is now an enemy of God, made to be so by God, will one day be reconciled to God, and every knee will bow, Paul, every knee. Just imagine this. You don't believe it, I know, but imagine that every knee, celestial, terrestrial, and subterranean, every realm that there is, every knee will bow to God and acclaim, not confess, but acclaim that Jesus Christ is Lord. What a satisfying ending. And everything happening now is working according to that plan. And imagine, Paul, that every single trial, every single judgment is working toward that goal, that the judgments aren't the goal. And that's the big mistake you're making right now, Paul. You're making the judgments. You're looking at the lake of fire. You're looking at the judgment of the nations. You're looking at the second death. You're looking at the Gehenna of fire. You're looking at sin. You're looking at mortality. And you're thinking that these things are the goal. These are the end of what God's great plan is. It's centered around the cross. Paul, no, these are means to an end. Imagine that all of these ugly things that we suffer through will have this glorious outcome, and it will all be justified. Every ugly thing God does, every pain we feel, every fear we entertain, every doom, every shade of doom hanging over our head will be justified in that it led us to this beautiful consummation where God will be all in all. So, okay, as I'm saying this, and it was like three times as long as this, three times as great. Well, maybe two times is great. This is pretty great. I'm looking over at Kelly. She, tears streaming down her face. I'm looking at Gabe. He was slack-jawed, sucking it up big time, almost reflecting the glow of it. And I looked at Paul, and he was looking right at me. And for a second, I thought, maybe this is landing. Maybe something is getting in. And as I concluded, and I had tears in my eyes also, and woven within this was my own testimony of realizing that it was all of God and not of me. The day I realized that I was no different, my flesh was no different than Adolf Hitler's flesh, and that I was chosen by God, not because of any worthiness of mine, but because of Christ. And I emphasized how Christ faced death, faced oblivion. He knew he wouldn't be alive. He knew that he, the man, the person, would no longer exist, would be dead. And the faith that had to engender in his Father to raise him, to rouse him from the dead. Paul's locked eyes with me. But when I finished, I forget the first thing he said, but it was evident, very quickly evident, that nothing had penetrated what I now call, and I think this is helpful for us to hear, a force field. He was steeling himself against this truth. These truths steeled against it. Very soon after I finished, I realized what I had been up against, a force field of absolutely not wanting any of these things to be true. He does not want these things to be true. He does not want to look into these things in order to understand them. The only way, the only reason he looks into them is to refute them. And he has the refutation in his mind first. It's not, I want to learn about this. No, it says, I'm going to pay attention to this very closely to make sure I can refute. I have to make sure I can refute everything my dad is saying. I have to make sure that I have a solid defense against the salvation of all, against the sovereignty of God, against the two gospels, against the death of Christ, because those are all the positions of his church. And I told him, Paul, oh, I said this to him. I said, I know you want to be a man of God, and you will truly become a man of God when these people, and remember, we're in the area where they have their church services, and there's 150 chairs all around them, all around us, and nobody was there, only the four of us. And I pointed to these chairs, and I said, when you are persecuted by these people, then you will be a man of God. When you are persecuted by these people, then you will know the suffering of Christ. But until you're persecuted by these people, you don't know what suffering for Christ is. You don't know what persecution is. The force field was so strong, nothing got in. And I told him, and he knows this, that when you make your living from the institution, and when you've applied your soul to it, and when it becomes your reputation, when your family's livelihood depends on it, and when other people look at you as the man of God, then it becomes so much more difficult to see the truth. Because if he were to see the truth, I said this to him, Paul, you know that if you were to see what we're saying, and find any point of agreement, you would be done here. I know, he said, I know, I would be done, I would be finished. He can't let that happen. That's how important the institution is. This is what our enemy has done. But while I say this, I have a soft spot, obviously, in my heart for Paul as my son. Bone of my bone, flesh of my flesh, and I love him. And again, I admire him for backtracking, for recanting his refusal to let me see my own grandkids. He said he went too far. And Paul, if you're watching this, I thank you for that. I thank you for that, for admitting you were wrong about that and backing off and opening this door of fellowship again, because, of course, it's a big mistake not to, not only now, but later, it's going to be even bigger. So thank you, Paul. I admire that. And your steadfastness to maintain the doctrines that your church believes was incredible. I've never seen anything like it. And when I think of the force field, I think I'll close with this, ladies and gentlemen. I think of Romans 11:32. We were all like this. God locks up altogether in stubbornness. So I guess what God would, what I would call, what I'm calling the force field, I detected probably like 2 feet of a force field shielding my son from the light, making sure none of the light got in. And you have to ask yourself, is this force field of Satan or is it of God? Well, in the relative viewpoint, it might be of the adversary, because Satan blinds the apprehensions of the unbelieving so that the glory of the illumination of God in Christ does not irradiate them, right? So that no light can get in. Basically, that's my paraphrase. Satan blinds the apprehensions. So the apprehension was blinded, even though the truth was coming at him full bore, from a man who's been trained in heralding the truth for almost 40 years, full bore, right at him. None of it got in, none of it. Unless, I don't want to sell God short here, unless something some little thing. By the grace of God, I didn't detect it, but now that I'm talking to you, it could have happened. Some little thing got through. And it's incubating, like the 200 million supernatural cavalry, incubating in the earth of my son. That could be because the Lord said to Saul, "Saul, Saul, why are you persecuting me? It is hard for you to kick against the goad." There was something goading Paul the whole time he was a Pharisee. So maybe there's a goad somewhere deep inside my son Paul. There's a goad. There's something kicking him. Maybe. Something I said that day, though by all appearances, nothing got in. I'm sorry. I'm sorry. I'm sorry because I should not sell God short. I couldn't detect it, but what is my detection? Nothing. Nothing. My powers of detection are nil. Only God knows. Something penetrated. A piece of the armor slipped a little bit. And maybe Paul's mind wandered for a second and something got in and lodged in the heart, lodged in the spirit. And it's now incubating. And the time will come when that grows and grows and it goes from the subconscious to the conscious. And then Paul says, and then God says to Paul, "It's hard for you. It's been hard for you to kick against this, hasn't it? How many months, how many days, how many weeks, how many months, how many years will my son kick against what got in, if by the grace of God, something got in? How long will he kick against it? I hope it's only a matter of hours, days at the most, but I don't know. If ever in this eon, I don't know, that's not my job. Paul says, I plant, Apollos waters, God causes the growth. So the force field is God locks up altogether in stubbornness. And we were once locked up in stubbornness with my son Paul. We were all there. I told Paul, I used to believe what you believe, son. I used to believe it. I didn't think of the force field then. I didn't have that term at my disposal that day. But this was just a few days ago, which is why it's so fresh in my mind. I'll stop talking about this. But we were once like you. None of us believed this. But the second half of Romans 11:32. God locks up altogether in stubbornness that he should be merciful to all. For whatever reason, Paul's not meant to hear it and receive it at this time. The hour will come when he will receive it. And I pray that it's sooner rather than later.